Okay, today we do news of the election and the politics of this economy, because, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 4th of November today. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. It is a very loose tradition on this program, on the day after a presidential election, to ask, now what? Now what happens with economic policy and jobs and wages and industries and companies and people and all of it? Can't do that today because, as you know, we've got a bunch of unknowns. So we are going to deal with the economic story right under our noses, which is, where is help coming from? With the virus still in charge and political Washington unwilling or maybe now unable to act. Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going.
Had there been a clear blue wave over the White House and Congress, economist Ian Shepherdson at Pantheon Macroeconomics expected lawmakers to spend $2 trillion to juice the economy. That's as much money as the CARES Act this spring, which sent checks to people out of work and families and small businesses. Now, he expects a far smaller turbo boost.
As we saw in the spring, the CARES Act put money into people's pockets extremely rapidly because of the one-time stimulus payments and because of the enhanced unemployment benefits, $600 a week to everybody.
He says congressional spending works much faster and in a more targeted way than stimulus from the Federal Reserve, which is meeting today and tomorrow. And the Fed's already been busy, having slashed short-term borrowing costs in March.
The question then becomes, what exactly can they do? They've already cut interest rates to zero.
Economist Matthew Lozetti at Deutsche Bank Securities says the Fed is also buying bonds to push down longer-term loan rates. Now, he says, it could pledge to buy more bonds every month, or it could signal it's willing to keep buying for a long time.
The intent would be to put more down pressure on interest rates, hopefully ease mortgage rates as well, to provide as much stimulus as they can to the economy.
It's important how the Fed communicates this. Investment strategist Lizanne Saunders at Charles Schwab, a Marketplace underwriter, says this spring the Fed's messaging settled nervous markets.
Simply the Fed saying, we've got the tools, we've got the ammunition, sort of the pulling out the bazooka, but not necessarily needing to use it. We saw the power of that. So my guess is they would try to sort of use their words, to put it very bluntly.
Still, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has said the Fed needs help from Congress. In a speech last month, he said too little stimulus would lead to a weak recovery. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I am not the first one to say this by a very long shot, but elections have consequences. And oftentimes, those consequences are economic. So let's do a little what-ifing here, shall we? What would have happened if the polls had been right and there was a Democratic sweep? And what's likely to happen in this economy the next few years if current trends hold? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
So a Democratic sweep of the House, the Senate, and the White House would likely mean more and larger coronavirus relief packages. That would drive economic growth, even factoring in proposed higher taxes on corporations and high income earners. Seth Carpenter is chief U.S. economist with UBS.
The Democratic sweep scenario and our modeling of it would result in about 3.25 percentage points faster GDP growth in 2021 than either of the split government scenarios.
More GDP growth, more jobs. Specifically, UBS predicts the unemployment rate 2 years from now under a unified Democratic government would be at 3.7%. Under a divided government scenario, it would be 5.8%. The divided government scenarios, also known as gridlock, slow down recovery. Keith Wade is chief economist at Schroders, an international asset manager.
Whoever wins the presidency is going to be facing a split Congress, which will limit their room for maneuver.
Wade says a split Congress under Biden would probably pass more stimulus than one under Trump, adding 2 to 3 tenths of a percent more in terms of GDP growth. Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
If it's a Biden presidency with a split Congress, I would expect the economy to get back to full employment about 3 years from now.
A second-term Trump presidency with a split Congress, Zandi argues, would take several months longer to get the economy back to full employment.
Only because he's going to continue to pursue his trade war and restrictive immigration policies, which are very negative for the economy.
Whichever version of split government we might get, and whichever one would perform better, both scenarios involve more partisan bickering and economic muddling along. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yes, bickering and muddling along. Choose your own motivation on Wall Street today. Yay, gridlock. Yay, no real election violence. Yay, democracy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's pick up on what Scott Tong started us off with a couple of minutes ago, the state of play post-election with a relief package, and what's going to happen or not in this economy because of it. 750,000 people lost their jobs 2 weeks ago. We will get an update on first-time unemployment claims tomorrow. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, a lot of those people who are out of work have similar stories to tell about dealing with long delays and trouble even getting benefits, about juggling work with homeschooling kids. All of that mixed in with plenty of financial struggles. Here's Mitchell.
Daniela Knight of Fairfax, Virginia, ticks off pretty much all of those issues, grappling with work and unemployment.
Is it okay if we have some child noises in the background? It's okay, yes. Constantly, all day long.
That's Knight's 3-year-old. She's also got a 5- and a 9-year-old.
No one's at school. Everyone is home.
When we spoke back in the summer, Knight was juggling 2 jobs, which she did at night to make ends meet. But she couldn't keep it up with homeschooling. Now she says she's
going through the stages of grief, in a way. I've been depressed, mourning life before. I have quit one of my jobs because, obviously, it was impossible.
Knight's husband just started a new job at a government agency after several months out of work.
So that at least was a big relief, but we still have not seen anything, any money from his unemployment benefits for the 2+ months that he was not employed.
They're expecting more than $5,000. Knight says the Virginia Employment Commission is still reviewing the claim.
We're trying as best as we can to keep up with bills.
Jobless benefits started coming in the spring for Ann Zebley of Kansas City, Missouri, when she closed her one-woman bakery in the first wave of COVID shutdowns. Like everyone on unemployment back then, she got an extra $600 a week in federal pandemic assistance.
That helped a little bit. That helped me pay my rent, basically, and keep electricity on.
In the summer, she reopened the bakery, first for a few hours, then a few days a week. But then she got COVID.
It's been rough, for sure. I have had the long-haul COVID stuff going on.
When she started feeling better, she reopened the bakery, which is just barely breaking even. And she dropped off unemployment. She says after the $600 a week federal payments expired in July,
my state benefit would have been $120. So instead, I just pushed and went back to work. I probably should not have done that. I was not contagious. I wasn't, you know, putting anybody else at risk, but I wasn't ready.
Fear of illness has kept some people on the unemployment rolls for the long haul. Mark Smith is in his late 40s. He worked as a janitor in a factory in Portland, Oregon for 25 years until it closed when the pandemic hit. Then he went on unemployment. He could look for another job, but he's decided not to.
I'm basically choosing as long as the pandemic and the emergency is still going on to be at least one less vector of possible contagion.
He has a roommate who works in healthcare and an elderly relative living with them. Smith's been getting about $300 a week on unemployment. At the beginning of October, he ran out of his 26 weeks of state benefits and applied for the 13-week federal extension.
I'm hoping, doing like fingers crossed.
It's been 4 weeks. So far, he hasn't gotten any money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I need you to follow me on this one for a minute here, but mobility was on the ballot here in California yesterday. Economic mobility, yes, but also actual mobility. Voters here took on the legendary Proposition 13, which more than 40 years ago sharply limited property taxes. That has had a whole bunch of unintended consequences, but one of them is that there hasn't been a whole lot of motivation to sell your house, buy a new one, and wind up with a bigger tax bill if you didn't have to. Not great for the housing market, not great for mobility, actual and economic, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
In 1978, an anti-tax crusader named Howard Jarvis led a taxpayer revolt in California. Facing rampant inflation and soaring property taxes, voters adopted Proposition 13.
We have proven here in California that we, the people, not the politicians, are still the boss.
The measure set property taxes at 1% of the purchase price and kept annual increases to no more than 2%, a way to help people stay in their homes longer by keeping their taxes affordable even as home values rose. They could also pass along their homes with their tax breaks to their heirs. Over the years, Prop 13 has cost the state billions in lost revenue and gutted public school funding. It's also given long-term homeowners a little too much reason to stay put, squeezing the supply of homes for sale.
There's like a disincentive to sell because, you know, you can keep and lock in these low property tax rates.
Whitney Thornton is a renter in Oakland, California, who would love to buy a house, but says even a fixer-upper in her neighborhood would cost at least $700,000, with a much bigger tax bill than a longtime homeowner down the street might pay.
My husband and I have honestly been talking about leaving California, which makes us, you know, sad. I think it's just really hard for my generation.
Proposition 19, which was backed and bankrolled by the California Association of Realtors, would let people age 55 or older sell their homes and take their tax breaks with them, up to three times. Michael Genest is a consultant to the Yes on 19 campaign.
If you're going to shift some people from the, no, I guess I'm going to stay here, to the, hey, I think I'm going to move category.
Jeanette says the measure could spur about 30,000 people a year to move, bumping up sales about 12% among older homeowners. Opponents see it as just another giant tax break for the privileged that will do little to address California's housing shortage. Either way, the lack of turnover in the housing market is much bigger than Prop 13, and it's bigger than California.
It's just this broad-based trend where you've had a nationwide fall in geographic mobility.
Lori Goodman is co-director of the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. She says in 1988, nearly one in five Americans said they'd moved within the past year. Now it's more like one in 10. And in the last decade, the median length of home ownership has grown from 10 to 13 years. Goodman says the rise of two-income families is one big reason people don't move as much.
The fact that more women are in the labor force, which makes it harder for, you know, the family just to uproot if you've got two earners.
Then there are all those aging baby boomers. Older people tend to move less. And that gums up the works for buyers who want to move up and first-timers who want to move in. Lawrence Yoon is chief economist with the National Association of Realtors.
So all that cascading impact is not occurring.
Yoon says building more new homes would help.
But home building has just simply not been there.
For years, and COVID-19 hasn't helped, construction slowed down in the spring. But Yoon says the pandemic could jumpstart the market in a different way. With about a quarter of Americans now working from home, he expects more people to move.
After years of decline, we may begin to see a little uptick in the upcoming years from this new economy of work-from-home flexibility.
In our most recent Marketplace Edison Research survey, almost half of people who'd recently moved or were considering moving told us one reason was the ability to work from anywhere. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The state of the presidential race being what it is, chances are pretty good your public radio station is going to preempt its usual programming the next day or so, which they should. And if they do, might I suggest the Marketplace podcast. The economy does not stop to count the votes, you know. Coming up.
Yeah, I think people are just so bored of staring at their walls.
Nothing a new coat of paint can fix, I'll tell you that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 367 today, 1.3%, 27,847. The NASDAQ gained 430 points, 3.8%, finished at 11,590. The S&P 500 up 74 points, 2.2%, 34.43 there. Tech, and more tech, people. Amazon up 6.3%. Apple up 4%. Facebook pocketed 8.3%. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note down 0.76%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Alongside the uncertainty of the presidential race, there were actually some conclusive and, oh, by the way, kind of interesting to note results last night. So, two stories now along those lines. Proposition 22 here in California put the gig economy on the ballot. It lets Uber and Lyft and DoorDash and the rest of the big gig platforms classify their drivers as contractors instead of employees. It won by a lot. And as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports now from the Workplace Culture Desk, that means it could play out well beyond California's borders.
Without this ballot measure, California would have forced a dramatic reshaping of the gig economy, says Harry Campbell of the Rideshare Guy blog.
We don't know exactly what would happen if drivers would become employees, but I think it's a safe bet that there would be less drivers. There would be more rigid scheduling.
With the success of Prop 22, that won't happen. The gig will stay in the gig economy in California. The mostly part-time drivers who like the flexibility to work here and there for whichever app they choose will continue to be able to do so with some added benefits, and the drivers who seek the security of full-time work will likely continue to be disappointed, he says. That's troubling to Rebecca Given, a professor of labor studies at Rutgers University.
This ballot initiative will embolden employers in all kinds of sectors to say, maybe we can do the same thing with wait staff in restaurants or supermarket cashiers.
She worries employers have learned a new way to circumvent labor laws they don't want to comply with. But Seth Orenberg, a law professor at Duquesne University, says
the passage of Proposition 22 is going to encourage new startups to pursue gig worker models and technologies because it just got less risky to do it.
By creating essentially a third class of worker, Prop 22 could also pressure other states and the federal government to change labor laws. NYU business professor Arun Sundarrajan says the California law provides a blueprint to revamp them.
We now have a framework to fund benefits, not just for full-time employees, but for people who have other work arrangements, for freelancers, for independent workers.
And he says that will become increasingly important as the nature of work, access to the safety net, and jobs continue to be challenged by the pandemic. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
In Florida, which President Trump won, Amendment 2 on the ballot there set the state's minimum wage at $15 an hour. It passed with a little bit more than 60% of the vote. This one is interesting to note because Republican politicians don't usually support raising the minimum wage federally or at the state level. But as Marketplace's Andy Eula reports, when the issue is on the ballot, voters tend to think otherwise.
Currently, Florida's minimum wage is $8.56 an hour. This measure will nearly double that by 2026. Ryan Feldman runs a coffee roasting business in southwest Florida, where he employs 14 hourly workers. He voted in favor of the increase, but says it could eventually have direct consequences on his business.
So down the pipeline, we'll either need to kind of rejiggle our budget, or we'll have to kind of keep the payroll costs in line and potentially let one or two people go.
That's exactly what opponents of Amendment 2 argued in Florida, that a wage raise would hurt small businesses, particularly those in the tourism industry, which is already struggling from the impacts of COVID-19. But Alexis Davis at the Florida Policy Institute says this is just about getting more money into workers' pockets.
Businesses in the state have made billions on the tourism and service sector for decades, long before this pandemic, and it's high time that they share the prosperity with the hardworking Floridians who made that happen.
Florida is the eighth state that has approved a $15 minimum wage. David Cooper at the Economic Policy Institute says it's states that are passing these measures because lawmakers in D.C. haven't. The House passed a similar bill last year, but it didn't go anywhere in the Senate.
In the absence of federal legislation, it's good that states are taking this up. But I think, unfortunately, there are going to be many states that are probably not going to take up this issue unless they're required to, either by voters or by the federal government.
The federal minimum wage is just $7.25 an hour. The measure in Florida will increase wages for about 2.5 million people, about 1 in 4 workers in the state. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Okay, something else. How about that? Like how not to go stir crazy as winter settles in, the virus ramps up, and we spend more time inside. That is a business opportunity, depending on your business. Say, paint? Kyle Chaco wrote about it for Art News. Kyle, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So this might be the simplest opening question in an interview I have ever asked, but here goes. paint? Really?
Yeah. I think people are just so bored of staring at their walls that they have wanted to repaint them.
Tell me about this engineer you started this piece with, because that is just, it's just symptomatic of so much of what's going on.
Yeah, so Maris Manstadt, who is an environmental engineer in Massachusetts, found out or like discovered that she was really not using the dining room of her home very much during quarantine because no one could come over. And she and her husband started using it as an office. But the dining room was painted this kind of dramatic dark salmon color, and it was not helping when the sun went down and everything got even darker. So they decided to repaint it, and they decided on this kind of light bluish gray color. And that has helped so far. Like they've been a little more comfortable in their dining room slash office.
And is that the trend? I mean, people are going away from the dramatic that used to be fashionable, and now they just want soothing tones because everything?
Yeah, I think like all this outward anxiety in the world and like how scary everything is makes you want to have your home be as safe and comfortable and non-dramatic as possible. So rather than this like popular or fashionable pink, like just going to something totally neutral and inoffensive.
I imagine paint companies are making money hand over fist.
Yeah, it's a huge jump. Like, I think Farrow and Ball's revenue has gone up 20% just this year. And I talked to a Irish brand called Curator who said that some of their colors jumped up like 60% during the pandemic. So it's actually kind of a bright spot for them.
You know, it's funny. You named two paint companies that I've never heard of. And we're not talking Sherwin-Williams here, right? These are higher-end paint companies.
Yeah, I think this is more kind of like they're already fashionable. They're kind of luxury paint brands.
Right. Let me get back to the actual colors that people are choosing. And I get not wanting drama and all of that, but why the blues and the greens, do you suppose?
Yeah, it's super fascinating. I mean, color is so psychological and emotional. I think it was kind of about bringing the outside world into your house a little bit more. So taking these organic colors that give you a sense of like the distance of the forest or the cloudy sky or something. So these soft greens and blues that give you a sense of like more space rather than the confinement of a darker color.
All right, here comes the deeply cynical question. Do you suppose once we can all not have to be in our houses all the time, people are going to go, oh my God, these greens and blues, this is terrible. Get me some salmon now.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll suddenly find that they're bored. So right now we're just so overstimulated that this comes as a break from that. But as soon as we can actually experience things again, I think fashion will change.
Right. And of course, paint companies will say, sure, we can sell you more paint. That'd be fine.
Right. They can do whatever. They can switch it up as soon as possible.
Right. Kyle Chaka writing in Art News about how we are coloring the spaces we live in. Kyle, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, Money in Politics edition. Credit to Axios for aggregating the data here. Make of this what you will, but Democrats most definitely did not get a great return on investment in the voting that ended yesterday. Jamie Harrison raised $109 million, lost to Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. Amy McGrath raised $90 million. Mitch McConnell won big in Kentucky. Sarah Gideon in Maine raised $69 million. Susan Collins is going back to the Senate from Maine. And in Texas, Mary Hager raised $24 million, lost to Senator John Cornyn. All right, we got to go, but not without your day after Election Day moment of economic context. We do this on Fridays every now and then, mostly tongue-in-cheek, but it seems apropos now, given that the Fed, as Scott Tong was talking about, is meeting today and tomorrow to pore over the state of this economy in the short and medium-term future. I don't have my usual Friday interlocutors, so let's do a little play-along at home, shall we? Five words or less, what is Jay Powell thinking? Hit me up on Twitter, at Kai Rizdahl. Let me know. All right, we're leaving. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They go to the studios so the rest of us don't have to, unless, of course, our home internet is terrible, as it is. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.